It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
He was licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
Man, I hate it till he bursts.
I'm painting me.
It's feeding time. I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit Fangoria.com. So we're coming back to cover the entirety of this last season of American Horror Story. In the previous episode, we talked about the premise, the characters, and the pilot episode, although I think they generally seem to get full seasons. They're not.
Yeah, it's not a pilot. We're not trying anything out with Ryan Murphy anymore.
Yeah, no, it's pretty well established.
Yeah. So though, but if you're jumping in right now, though, go back and listen to 2 weeks ago's episode so that you can start at the beginning.
So episode two, named "Chutes and Ladders," starts off with a bang.
Mm-hmm.
It is massive. We were just talking about the length of it. Like, it's almost a feature film in itself, and it's one of the great ones. Like, it does all the great stuff and very little of the shitty stuff, the West Bentley.
Yes, actually, there's very little of those bad characters. It's all the characters you care about.
Yeah, and I think it's probably telling that it was written by Tim Minear, who was a name that I recognized from Joss Whedon stuff back when he was doing Firefly. And he's kind of a gun for hire. He's a great writer. He seems to have a relationship with Fox, and he also worked with Joss Whedon on Dollhouse as well as Firefly. Okay. So, like, he's pretty well established, and this is a really well-written episode, and also scary. They don't always venture there, but you know what? Something occurred to me that we didn't really talk about the opening credits of the show, and they kind of – I think every season they set the tone – really well, even though the show is known for, like, the cold open.
Right.
So they do like to sort of jump in, you know, the train is rolling, you gotta run and hop on, but then you get hit with the credits, and the first thing that came to mind is that they're like the Mark Romanek music videos that he did for Nine Inch Nails. Like, he did Closer. I think he might have done The Perfect Drug. He did some Madonna stuff, but he also did the Johnny Cash cover of Hurt.
Right.
And that video is just like entropy personified.
Right.
Yeah. That said, he didn't direct this. It's just a funny, like, coincidence that it's an aesthetic that they've pursued.
I remember seeing the first season, and the first opening sequence for the first season is scary as shit. And every single week I would sit there and be like, oh, this is so scary. And I had never really seen anything like that on TV.
Yeah, and I guess in this one they do use the Ten Commandments to sort of – they're very briefly on screen, but you do get a glimmer of like, oh, that's familiar. Thou shalt not kill, etc.
Right.
And so that kind of lends to the storyline of the Ten Commandments killer – who, later we find out is part of J.P. March's sort of lifelong goal.
Right.
And episode two gives us J.P. March's whole background.
Right. It's the first time we meet him is in episode two, because I kept hearing Evan Peters was going to be in the show, and then I thought, oh, they're going to waste him like they did in Coven. And then when he comes out, it's like so cool. He's so cool.
Yeah. So we've already established that the hotel is up for sale, and it's going to be sold
to Cheyenne Jackson.
Cheyenne Jackson is playing the fashion designer. Remember his name. Will Drake.
It's very fancy.
Yeah. So I think rather than sort of fight City Hall, the Countess, Lady Gaga, decides, like, no, the move, especially because I'm broke, the move is to ingratiate herself and, you know, do the sort of hypnotic eyes with Will Drake and get him to marry her and get his money. This all happens sort of in the plotting and scheming, but this is also the episode that we are introduced to, I can't remember the model's name.
Tristan.
Yeah. So the Will Drake pulls off a fashion show in the lobby.
Right.
And there's a really sad Sally moment where she is furious she wasn't invited.
So is there a problem here?
Yeah, I'm not on the list.
I'm not sure who you are.
I goddamn live here!
All right.
This is a private affair, dear.
The event's full. Maybe next time.
Come on, man. This is my house. Get over me! money.
And then the kids see it, and it's like, oh, not in front of the children. Keep your patheticness away from the children.
Everybody else in the hotel, well, everybody who isn't a sad sack seems to have been invited to this thing. Just because, like, hey, man, we're having a fashion show in your home.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you could swing by. But for her, she has to announce that she lives there, goddammit.
So sad, right? Aw. And then we got a cameo by Naomi Campbell.
Yeah.
Who's fucking amazing.
The episode starts off with a pretty quick kill, and we get this great back and forth between Liz Taylor and Iris.
Mm-hmm.
I've always admired the Swedes and their chocolate. It's a wonder they stay so thin.
Chocolate's the Swiss.
And it's just they're like really... really comfortable rapport between the two of them and disposing of this body.
They've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, you get that sense, and it's just right into the seeming like garbage / human shoot.
Right, which is where I said 2 weeks ago's episode, you'll see the guy in the bed again because the guy in the bed's body is actually down there with the lime and everything.
Mm. And we do get... Well, actually, I think he doesn't come back until later. He comes back to go after Naomi Campbell, but we'll come to that. But I did love that dynamic. It sort of spells out like the banality of evil.
Right.
But this hotel, you know, it's almost like cosmically objective. It's just like if you're going to come here, you know, it's a coin toss whether or not
you're probably going to die or you're going to become a ghost or you're maybe a vampire if you're lucky. Are you lucky? I don't know. I think you'd be lucky to be a vampire and hang out with Countess.
So long as you stay on her good side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
But she is a little. Temperamental. Yeah. There is this sort of boring side story of Close 70, and I guess at this point it's Wes Bentley's cop character who gets glimpses of his son and he thinks he's going nuts, and it turns out his son is actually in the hotel.
People could see my face while we're recording this. It's just like all eye rolls and heavy, like angry breathing.
But what does get cool is when Lady Gaga, the Countess, is talking a little bit about herself and how, like, she was a disco queen.
Yeah.
You know, she's been around, and I guess I can never remember the model's name. Tristan.
Yes.
She's explaining to Tristan a little bit of her background.
Because he also asked her, like, when's your favorite time? And
yeah, and I guess she has just recently turned him, so he's kind of learning the ropes.
Right.
And she's also giving her history background, and so it's pretty cool seeing her in that era. There's a really, like, really somber moment where she's talking about, like, that being her favorite era,
mm-hmm.
the late 70s specifically, and, you know, we cut to her with some pretty flamboyant hair and riding in on a white horse.
As you do. I think everyone did that in the 70s, right?
She ruled the disco era. But then it comes down where she's talking about all the friends she's lost to AIDS, and it humanizes this, you know, creepy vampire.
Yeah, because she's not cold. I mean, she comes off, I think, sometimes as being very cold. But she's a person who's completely driven by her relationships that surround her.
Yeah. And, yeah, I don't know. That moment really struck me. And it was just a reminder. I think there's probably something in every single episode that is, you know, kind of a shout-out. It's funny that, like, I think by the time this aired, Glee was done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Glee, hugely progressive in terms of popular culture. And, like, you know, whether people recognize it at the time that, like, hey, man, all of a sudden you may not realize, but, like, this is an incredibly gay-friendly show. This is incredibly realistic in terms of
society.
What kids deal with.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, before you grow up to have whatever prejudices you do, like, yeah, man, in urban places, you're going to have all kinds of people mingling. And in this case, like the show, and we're going to talk about Liz Taylor a little bit later, but it is like through and through, it's odd to think of a horror show as like positively portraying LGBTQ people.
Right.
But they are throughout these stories.
I think you can say anytime you're portraying them in any group of people in a way where they are human and have the same feelings. Everyone has these feelings. And so I think it's always a positive thing when you see somebody just being completely normalized, just as if everyone else is very equal in
and
this show.
Comfortable in their skin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
it goes a long way. Recently, the Women in Caskets did a sort of retrospective on the show Supernatural, which I'm a fan of. I've kind of checked in and out from time to time. But they did sort of recognize that, like, if you do the straight numbers of, like, who's portrayed and how they come off mm-hmm. and maybe how they're dispatched, they have killed a lot of minority characters, LGBT people, and they don't really give it a second thought. Like, it just kind of...
See, I never watched Supernatural, so I'm not, like, up on that.
It didn't occur to me until they said it, and then I'm thinking back that, like, yeah, I guess in the show cycle of, like, characters coming in, characters going out, they've gotten rid of a lot of gay characters. They've gotten rid of a lot of, like, African-American characters and women. They're not especially nice to women.
Really?
Yeah.
I only know about those two guys, so, I mean.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of how they get by, that, like, mm-hmm. those guys, you know, at their worst, they're anti-heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you kind of gloss over all this other subtext.
Right. In this episode, we're first introduced to J.P. March, and we get to see his relationship with Mara Winningham, which, like I said the last, like, 2 weeks ago, how much I love Mara Winningham. And we get to see their dynamics, and there's this great scene when the police come, when you're back in time to when J.P. March was alive the first time. I don't know how to explain ghosts like that. But you have this great scene with him and Mara Winningham, and the cops are knocking on the door. And J.P. March, you know, he says, well, let's do this together.
Yeah, the jig is up. The cops are on
to
him.
And Mara Winningham wants to die with J.P. March.
Oh, Miss Evers. You have always been the only one I can count on. You are a pillar. And so I give you the honors. What order shall we die in?
Oh, Mr. March. Oh, I really don't know. Well, a part of me wishes you would go first so I could launder the sheets. There's no time for that, is there?
No. It seems not.
As much as I like her character, like, they're... You know, it's funny. She is chipper for, like, 90% of the show. And in these glimpses back in the 1920s, we get a look at, like, she is like, the most codependent.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so desperate to please this guy. Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of sweet, but at the same time heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But it was, I don't know, it was kind of fascinating to see them sort of go off together.
Yeah.
And
it's just one of my favorite scenes because it's so funny.
The execution of that, yeah, that scene is pretty wild. I really liked it. The next episode is, you know, it's kind of like after the second episode, and it's huge. It's like almost an hour and 15 minutes. The third episode brings us more backstory of Chloe Sevigny and Wes Bentley. And
no one cares. Show me more Gaga.
Then Holden showed up. It was a tectonic shift where everything I thought I knew about myself got rearranged. It was like I finally fell in love for real. All the cracks and missing pieces came together. I felt whole. I'd found my soulmate.
That's the love of her life.
And I guess they're establishing the, like, ridiculous idea that she would want to spend all of eternity
mm-hmm.
in specifically that mode. Like, not even getting to see her son grow up. But just
she
being
just
able
doesn't
to,
mind. Yeah, she just wants to be with him.
Yeah, smell his lilac-scented head. Like, it's just...
I don't know. I don't have a kid, so I don't know about this. But I love my dog a lot. That's as close as I can get to that, you know? I don't relate to this character.
Right, but you don't love your dog more than you love your husband.
Some days.
It's in the third episode that we get the Angela Bassett introduction.
Right.
And I guess she saves Donovan slash kidnaps Donovan.
She kind of kidnaps him. Because Donovan now is been kicked to the curb by Gaga because she's now with Tristan and sort of Will Drake. It's this whole thing.
They're sharing him temporarily, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't exactly make any sense, but whatever. And she kicks Donovan to the curb, and that's when he is now able to be kidnapped by Angela Bassett.
Yeah, and it turns out she, you know, she could care less about Donovan. Right. It's about having a mole into the hotel, having an inn that I guess she is eager to, like, take out the Countess's legs out from under her.
Right, because at first she's going to kill Donovan to piss off Gaga, kind of.
Right.
But then she realizes, like, oh, she actually doesn't even know that you're around anymore.
Yeah.
Who the hell are you?
Now, that's the wrong question. What you should be asking is, who was I?
Somebody order room service.
I was the queen of them all.
No, we ordered hookers.
Get on your knees.
I don't get on my knees for no man.
Cut! Check your gate.
Woo! That look good.
I'd come to Hollywood with barely a high school education and no prospects. It wasn't long before I was a star.
We do get the flashbacks of her and Gaga together.
Yeah.
And that was pretty sexy. I mean, not to be like stereotypical dude, but like, you know what? I think Angela Bassett might have been a little shy because she's actually, in all the sex on the show,
In the least amount.
She's in the least amount, and even like when they're getting down, she's still like almost fully clothed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I don't know. I guess it's in her contract.
We do get to see her and the Countess sort of together for decades. Mm-hmm. And there's a great montage in the elevator where we sort of see their fashion.
Yeah.
And them slowly growing apart.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a really good shot. Iris, played by Kathy Bates, features, we get a little bit more, not all of it, but we get a lot more for her background and what she's doing there. And that Donovan has been cast aside by the Countess. She thinks that's her in.
Right, right.
To, like, re-ingratiate herself.
Now she can get back in with Donovan.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work, and he says, like, horrible, horrible things to her.
I will live with the addicts in Shitter's Alley. In a box in MacArthur Park, covered in the piss and shit of this horror of a city, before I even consider living under the same roof as you again.
I will say that it takes a lot for her to get the message.
Yeah, I know. I don't feel sorry very much for her in this whole show. I rarely do, just because I don't particularly like that kind of character. And also, like, Matt Bomer is so cool. I don't care how he talks to his mom. But anyway, so mean to her. Iris then enlists the help of Sally to get a bunch of drugs, and she's going to kill herself, which is, like, an awful way to kill yourself, quite honestly.
And you think that she would have the smarts to not want to be trapped in the hotel, because I think she's got to recognize at this point that if you die in the hotel, you're done.
Yeah, she definitely knows. I mean, she shows that,
like,
she knows it later.
Haunt her son for eternity, but there's no guarantee he's even going to be there.
Yeah, but she probably because she's so annoying.
He's so mixed up.
She's so annoying. Could you imagine like this annoying mother like haunting you all the time? Like, did you take your vitamins? Did you do your laundry?
You look a little faint. Did you drink blood today?
And then next episode then becomes pretty great episode, Devil's Night. It's silly and it's goofy, but I still kind of liked it.
I liked it, and I felt a little bit guilty because depending on who you are, it might come off in terrible taste.
Oh, it's in terrible taste. If you are a victim or a family of one of the victims, which there's a lot of victims between all these people here. But I still liked it.
In the last episode that we talked about American Horror Story Hotel, we talked about how the hotel acts as a sort of death anchor.
Right.
And whoever passes through the hotel, if the hotel seems to take a liking to you, upon your death, you're going to come back at the very least once a year on Devil's Night. And so what we're talking about, potentially in poor taste, well, probably not potentially, probably definitively
totally.
In poor taste, is the idea that now we have a collection of mass murderers, serial killers, making their return for a sit-down dinner with the all-time winner, J.P. March.
Right, because he has, like, organized this crew.
I want to fucking tear you apart.
Thank you all for being here on Devil's Night. But it is I who should be the one celebrating you. I look around and I see the definition of American success.
And we have Richard Ramirez.
Help me! There's a killer after me!
And a killer before you. Ricky! Found your presents. Taurus from Arizona. Marriott was full. Come! Finish her off.
We have John Wayne Gacy, who is John Carroll Lynch, who I love. He's so sweet.
He's really good and creepy in this.
He's so good. We have Jeffrey Dahmer.
Even outside
Dahmer.
Of the makeup, before he even puts on the makeup, he's just unsettling.
He's really good because he's so calm. He has such like a calmness to him.
Well, wasn't Gacy like from Wisconsin? He's like a nice Midwestern boy.
as much as a serial killer can be. Jeffrey Dahmer's there, who's played by Seth Gable, who I recognize from like bit parts in some TV shows.
Yeah, he was in Fringe, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like really handsome in real life, but he's playing Jeffrey Dahmer. And there were parts of this I was watching and I was like, is that Jeffrey Dahmer kind of hot? And it was like, this is like, what is wrong with you?
Wow, in his like woodshop teacher glasses?
Only
his,
in
like,
this.
Pedophile
only
glasses?
In this TV show, not in real life.
Oh, okay, well.
I'm not crazy. But in this TV show, he's a Seth Gable's a pretty handsome fella to be Jeffrey Dahmer, is all I'm saying.
We get Eileen Wuornos.
Yeah, which thing I kind of really didn't like.
It's so heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. So Lily Rabe? How do you say her last name?
I guess
Robbie, right? Lillian. I think it's Robbie.
Like the broccoli?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Eileen Wuornos is... she's the first person we see of the group, and she kind of fucks around with Wes Bentley and scares him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody familiar with the movie Monster, or there have been a number of documentaries about Eileen Wuornos...
I thought it was debatable whether she actually belongs there.
Right, I guess...
Because she's not...
She's gone back and forth on whether or not she was, like, a sadist.
Right.
Or she was defending herself. But in any case, like, she put herself in a scenario a number of times where she killed men. So it's more than coincidence.
Kind of it's not like she accidentally killed these men. But, I don't know, to me it's a very different kind of crime than someone like a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Gacy. Mm. So it's kind of... I don't exactly understand why she was there. Also, it was very heavy-handed, and I...
Yeah, she does a signature hair flip, like, 27 times. Mm-hmm, and it's maddening.
Yeah, it's like when people, like, act like they're Cher and do that, and you're just like, please stop doing that. That Cher does that, but, you know, it was similar to that. Like, please stop doing that.
Yeah, yeah. So she was the one weak link. I think we do get... A very quiet Zodiac killer.
Yeah, I was like, one of your favorite people shows up, and he's in a mask.
Okay. Favorite people. I like the movie. So separate from the party and this sort of insanity of a, you know, round table of murderers, we do go back to... Chloe Sevigny finds her son and sort of recognizes that, like, he's been affected. She doesn't know exactly how bad he is until she takes him home and he eats the dog.
Yeah, which there was a few things. Like, this kid, firstly, was a kid who got kidnapped, maybe ran away and got kidnapped. She doesn't know. If you're Chloe Sevigny, you don't know.
Right, he only went missing.
So she goes to another room. You would not let that kid out of your, like, sight. This is firstly, she's saying, you know, this is the love of her life. You would tie a rope around that kid and tie him to you. I don't understand why she would let him be alone for a second.
He clearly likes to wander.
Clearly. And in this case, now you've lost the dog because your son ate the dog. Good for you. Now everyone's suffering.
I think in the previous episode, she's treating the kid who has the measles.
There's that whole anti-vax thing.
Yeah. There's a subplot that sends that kid... to like sort of start his own collection of vampire friends. And I kind of like the idea of like a feral troop of kids. It was like our gang.
I think, yeah, everyone likes that.
Drink! It'll make you feel awesome.
That kid's mother is actually from Twin Peaks. And she's
I didn't recognize her until you said it, but holding it together. But yeah, so once her kid eats the dog, you know, it's a clear symbol that, like, what have they done to you? They've turned you into a monster.
Yeah, and you're a savage.
In the previous episode, we find out the sort of do's and don'ts of these vampire nouveaus. They're far more human. I thought it was interesting the take on vampirism that really the only definitive benefit is that if you can play your cards right, you can live forever.
Right, right.
But, you know, it seems like no one aside from Lady Gaga gets the, like, you know, hypnotizing powers. I think Donovan shows a little extra strength.
It's just that she's so cool.
Lady Gaga, if she's rocking the cat eyes, she can hypnotize
most civilians. Exactly, exactly. She has no superpowers except for being awesome.
The next episode is Room Service, and we get introduced to some fresh blood, which are the obnoxious hipsters.
So obnoxious.
I want to say they're a parody. I want to think that those characters are hyperbolic, but I suspect like those people exist in maybe Silver Lake definitely. And outside of LA. Like they are used to being accommodated. Like this is the sort of
an absurd accommodations.
Yeah, these are like the worst version of millennials. And it's funny that Iris in the previous episode, after sort of wanting to opt out, and Sarah Paulson as like Syringe Sally tries to accommodate her.
I like how you changed your name from Hypodermic Sally to Syringe Sally.
Oh, I was going for the alliteration.
It makes much more sense.
I forgot. You know what? I frankly forgot it was Hypodermic Sally. But it doesn't roll off the tongue.
No, it doesn't. Alliteration's always the best way to go. You should call up Ryan Murphy right now.
So by this point, Iris has turned. Iris is a vampire. And it's kind of hilarious to watch her deal with just these monstrosity of 20-somethings.
Right, because now she has no tolerance times 100.
And she's hungry.
Yeah.
So eventually when she hits her breaking point, it's kind of perfect.
Which I understand because I get very hangry. I'm one of those people that gets like so mad. So I totally get it. And if Darren Criss was like complaining about every little thing in my hotel, I would be so pissed off too. I wouldn't take that shit, that's for sure.
This episode does have the sort of redeeming element of getting the backstory to Elizabeth Taylor. Dennis O'Hare, this is the only time we get him sort of, we'll say, like, out of character.
Right.
Dennis O'Hare starts off as a pretty mild-mannered fella.
He's a salesman, a traveling salesman.
And I guess there's some convention in town, so he's there with, you know, fellow bros.
Yeah.
And when he sort of, like, defaults to his true nature and dresses as he feels comfortable as Elizabeth Taylor with, you know, full gown and makeup.
With the help of Countess.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God.
Get out. Get out of my room. This isn't what it looks like.
I've been watching you, love. I saw you come into the lobby. You dress like a man, walk like a man. But you smell like a woman.
It's Paco Rabanne.
Not your skin. Your blood.
It's a great thing because you kind of think that she is so out of character, Liz Taylor specifically, that you kind of think like she might be a ghost, she might be a vampire. Mm-hmm. There's something like otherworldly about her. And in, you know, the previous episode that we talked about this, we sort of did point out that Dennis O'Hare is so good at this that he glows.
Yes, yes.
Like he carries himself like he's like walking 3 inches over the ground.
Right, right. And to see then in this episode, we see how the Countess lets him realize who he is. I mean, that he is Liz Taylor. And then she becomes this beautiful otherworldly creature, yeah. Very similar to Gaga in that way.
You're so beautiful.
Why do you cry, love?
I'm so ugly.
No. You don't lack beauty. You lack commitment. Let me help you. To become who you were born to be.
There's being a woman, and then there's being Liz, who's glamorous and everything that anyone would aspire to be. And it's so exciting.
With that white slip and shame wrapping fur, I christen you Liz Taylor, a la Butterfield 8. Let's go to the Roxy. You can borrow one of my Halstons. I'll call it Mick Jagger.
I can't go out like this.
Oh, honey. Goddesses don't speak in whispers. They scream.
Until his coworkers catch him.
Yeah, and there's that, like, kind of gut punch where you see his face. And, like, he's so good.
Mm-hmm.
But that moment where, like, you know, he feels like he's been revealed. He's been exposed. And Lady Gaga's there to sort of course correct and be like, no, fuck those dudes.
Right.
I will cut their heads off if need be. And so he's kind of, you know, it seems like he's always got an allegiance to her for
of
that.
Of course. I think one of the best things, and it is though when he's found out, is that what Countess has Liz do is literally just go down to get ice. Mm. So she goes out in her new clothes and her new look and everything. And it's something that I think so many people take for granted, just a trip down the hall. But for Liz, it was life-changing.
Yeah, that was her catwalk.
Yeah, and I think, like, wow, how amazing that someone who is, let's say, gender-conforming to what they are born don't ever think about.
Mm.
But this time Liz gets to really dress up, and for her, that walk is just like everything in the world.
Okay. So we're not ready to scream. How about a tiny yelp just to warm up the pipe? Go down the hallway and fetch us some ice.
I never felt so naked in all of my life. The shame of nudity. But also the freedom.
And that's why it's incredibly sad when
it's so crushing when the guys like start, you know, talking down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and dressing her down, so to speak.
So episode 6 is room 33. And this one comes and takes us back to Murder House.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a monster story.
Yeah, it's a lot of a monster story. And it made me want to watch Murder House. See, I know you've seen Murder House more than me. I think I've only seen it once all the way through.
Yeah, I guess I've revisited.
Yeah, and so I kind of want to watch it again because we're introduced to 1926 Gaga as she was. And she, at this point in time, is pregnant, very pregnant.
Yeah, with, I guess, J.P. March's kid? Do they ever say? I don't think they ever say.
Yeah, I don't know.
Although it's a monster baby, so perhaps it's Salvatore's?
I don't know.
Well, it's less than human.
Yes, so she goes, though, because she knows this is kind of weird. She knows something's, like, up with this.
Mm.
She goes to Murder House to get an abortion from the doctor who lives at Murder House. And instead, they cut the baby monster out, and it proceeds to jump on people's faces and kill them, as a baby does.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a hell baby. Or is the movie It's Alive was the demon baby?
Yes, with the hand coming out of the cradle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's really cool, and I'm really looking forward to going back to Murder House to see that. But what it does, though, is kind of tell us that there is this monster baby living somewhere in the hotel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lady Gaga is very attached. I mean, understandably.
Yeah.
She it becomes more apparent later on, but she doesn't think any differently about her monster baby than, say, like Chloe Sevigny does about right. her albino kid.
Right, right. Because this monster baby is a fighter.
Continuing on the note of Liz Taylor and sort of filling out her story, in this episode she finds love.
Right.
And for better or worse, it is with Tristan, who Lady Gaga at this point has, you know, cast aside to prioritize with Will.
Right.
And so Tristan is now a turned vampire without a home. He's the kind of guy who's burned most of his bridges.
Yes, he is a butthole.
And the like the friendly face of Liz Taylor like allows him to like find some comfort, and they do fall for each other, and it, you know, without judgment, it is a little bit codependent, and it becomes apparent in their pillow talk.
Yes.
But there's no getting around the point that like Liz Taylor loves this kid.
Yeah, and he loves her in a way that he, you know, even when he was with Lady Gaga in the beginning, it just he always was not 100% in that relationship.
This is far more maternal, this yeah. relationship with Liz Taylor. I think there is a certain amount of tenseness because they know that Lady Gaga is territorial
right.
and possessive, even to those she's cast aside. So, you know, this is a relationship on a tight wire.
Yes,
and
this is all in secret. We get to see that play out. Which, how many secrets can you have when ghosts can do whatever the hell they want?
Yeah.
And you find out later that they don't even have to show themselves. They can just be invisible, the ghost people. So, I don't know. I think if I was J.P. Marge, I'd been like, guess what's happening?
Right.
You know he would have done that. But yeah. Apparently he's distracted during this time.
Yeah, he's kind of become
obsessed. Or he's just not interested.
Wes Bentley's character. It's just...
He's busy, so he doesn't have time to snitch.
Yeah, it's funny. As great as Evan Peters is, they kind of don't give him enough to do when they put him with Wes Bentley. Mm-hmm. And that they have a whole subtext to the arc of the season is just kind of, I don't know, feels like a little bit of a waste. Evan Peters is so good that you want to see him on camera with other people as good.
Right, right.
And Wes Bentley, you know, couldn't collect his shoes. Like, he's not good.
Couldn't collect his shoes. Is that a saying?
I just made it up.
The seventh episode is Flicker. I don't quite understand why. Why? Because of Valentino movies? Why?
The old-timey movies.
Okay.
Yeah,
I did.
Well,
that
Valentino
right?
was like a pre-talkies
I
star.
I got you. It takes us back in time to 1925. These aren't my favorite episodes because I don't really care for this particular part of the story.
Yeah, we've got the same actor who plays Tristan now playing a 1920s Italian film star.
Rudolph Valentino.
But I was with you. I never really liked it. I liked their reveal and this sort of hallway that had been locked off.
Oh, I love the idea of vampires getting walled off forever.
Yeah,
that's like a terrifying thing to me. So I do love that kind of a thing. I like the idea of 1926 Gaga kind of being in this threesome with these people.
And it's the only time that we see her in this like subservient role.
Right.
In this, you know, she is the lesser.
Right.
Only in the context of that relationship. Yeah, so that was kind of neat. I like the change of dynamics there.
And I did like, which a lot of people didn't, I liked that they used Fenwick Rock again. Not in any prosthetics, not in any disguise. It's just everyone, we only use so many people here, so you now know that this guy is a different guy entirely.
Yeah, I guess it's not uncommon that like in vampire stories, if anyone's lived long enough, they kind of become infatuated with a new person that reminds them of an old person.
Right, right.
So that's kind of what they're doing.
But I didn't mind it.
Yeah, I mean, it explains a lot because when the Countess goes after Tristan, even Donovan points out that, like, he's a bimbo.
Right.
And what are you doing with him? And, you know, she's not going to explain herself to anybody.
Right. No,
but in this case, like, she's clearly seeing in him what she wants to see.
Right.
And what she wants to see is Sal.
Right, Salvatore. Right, right. Which kind of makes sense because I think before the show started, I think it was you who said all these guys look alike.
Yeah, well, they got, and they got some heat when they announced the cast for this season. You know, any critic with a pair of eyes recognized that, like, how many chisel-chinned brunette guys are you gonna cast in this show? How about a little bit of diversity?
Right.
And it turns out, like, they're all there for a very specific reason, because the Countess has a type.
Exactly. Black Irish is her type. So you have this dark hair, these blue eyes, and jawline for days. And I understand, because I'm all about that aesthetic. That is my aesthetic as well. So, I mean, I was fine, but sometimes I had trouble at the beginning telling, like, Will Drake apart from sometimes Matt Bomer.
I still kind of have that problem.
I think Matt, now I'm, like, really on, like, team Matt Bomer, and I think he's really handsome. So I can tell him apart now, but it's very difficult. They all looked alike.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, at that point, like, you can't really criticize a show for its casting, because this is a sort of, it was a writing choice.
Right. Yeah. And it makes sense, but it was like, what are, and even John, I'm surprised that Gaga never had a thing for John Lowe, because he also fits this blue-eyed, black-haired guy.
If only to see Wes Bentley have his throat slashed. If only.
If only. It would have been the worst acting ever. It would have been like Paul Rubens in the Buffy movie. But like with no irony.
Yeah. He's like, this scene, I took influence from Jerry Lewis. And it was a good... The next episode is The Ten Commandments Killer.
Behold, the unfinished work of James Patrick March. This was to be my crowning achievement, my Hamlet. Well, really more of a sonnet when you compare it to my earlier work. What I really loved about this project was its simplicity of statement, the elegance of a round number, 10. Which makes it even more vexing I was never able to complete it.
When I was watching this live, like, because I was watching it as it was coming out week by week,
yeah,
it slowed down. In any of the John-centric episodes, I was like, next week it'll stop.
We get to see him being a cop, and none of, I mean, I guess the theme of the Ten Commandments Killer is kind of interesting in that you get these sort of gory post-mortem crime scenes.
Sure.
But anytime you get to see him acting like a cop, it's just kind of, you're not Batman. Stop talking like that. Like, it's just
so silly. Ugh. He tries really hard, probably.
Yeah, I do get that feeling. Yeah. But it's not working, Wes. But in any case, anything with Evan Peters is great.
That's
true. We sort of get the broader story arc that he sees his work as being unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
And in that second episode, in that long flashback of his history.
Well, if you want to know what this place is about, you have to know about the man who built it. James Patrick March. He put every atom of evil in his being into building this hotel.
It almost harkens back to the original Frankenstein when he's talking about, I know what it feels like to be God.
Right.
And so Evan Peters, as J.P. March, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes, wants to kill God.
You think there's hope now? You think God is going to protect you from the head of this hammer or the six floors you're about to fall?
As long as there is a God, men like you can kill thousands, millions, but you will never find peace.
Well, I guess I'm just going to have to kill God.
That's okay. All right.
Well, he has goals, and they're very high. And you can't, shoot for the stars, you'll hit the moon or some shit, right?
Good enough for me. Yeah, that sounds good. I guess this whole time, Sally has been infatuated with John
like really
for
into
no
John,
reason.
Cause, well, because he kind of treats her bad.
Yeah, I guess
I
any opportunity to cry, she's just like, I'm on that.
She's like, I was already crying, so this is excellent. I've got tears on deck.
So yeah, their story kind of spirals and...
Yeah, there's a lot of things we can't get into just because of, I don't want to spoil it for people.
Sure.
It's a decent reveal about everything that's going on, so I don't want any like shit on that.
So as if Sally could ever get the win, she is promised that when it's all said and done, she can have John.
Yes.
And like, come on.
But like, also like, maybe John should agree to this. Like, it's right. Not even taking his feelings into account.
Yeah, no, J.P. Marsh is just kind of...
That's years later when I'm done.
Yeah,
thank you.
Meanwhile, that's ironic. He is actually Lucy with the football, and Sally is going to be Charlie Brown taking another kick at it. And just going to, you know that ball is coming away.
Like, I wish like I knew more about J.P. Marsh and Sally together, because you only see really a couple of scenes with them.
Yeah.
And I might like to see how they interact, because... I think he has no tolerance for that kind of behavior.
Yeah, I get the feeling he wouldn't give the time of day.
I want to see it though.
just to see her take more abuse.
Right. If there was like some like alternate version of this show, I would like to see it.
Got a big plan, this mindset, maybe it's right at the right place.
So in episode 9, she wants revenge. The Countess is sort of enacting her plan. Well, her and Will are married.
Right.
And, so the operation begins, although Will has to meet her kid and actually doesn't do so by choice.
No. March shows him. She's not like she was like, hey, check out this kid that I also have.
Right. I would imagine if it was up to her, she'd probably sort of warn him that, like, my kid's not like other kids.
No, because I don't think she cares. She's just going to kill him. All she wants is to kill him.
I got the feeling that there were a couple moments here and there where she considered not killing him. Staying with him for a decent amount of time.
I could be completely wrong. Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't think she was going to... It's not like you don't bring this guy home to meet your parents,
Yeah.
She just wants to marry him and then kill him.
And I guess, it almost acts as an excuse to kill him when it is J.P. Marsh who shows...
Yeah, he shows him.
Yeah, and so, when one... faces down with an inhuman monster and then responds, in terror and fear and repulsion.
That's not nice.
Holy shit, what the hell is that thing?
And to think I was prepared to love and raise your son.
What is going on? What is this, some sort of prank? That thing can't be yours. It doesn't even look human.
I thought to kill you in Paris, but I could never stomach traveling with someone who said such hateful things about my child. I'm going to make sure you suffer immensely.
No, she doesn't think that's awesome at all. And she puts him in the walled up area. Because why not? Walled up areas for everybody.
I think at this point they've revamped that hallway and now it's like a very fancy electronically locked door.
Yeah,
right? It's got a keypad.
Yeah, but you can't keep ghosts in there. Like, kind of the idea, it seemed like she was building it, was to put March in there or something. I didn't quite understand what was going on, but it was kind of...
Well, I figure in the hotel that she seems to never want to really leave permanently, she'll vacation, sure. But, probably good to have a prison. It's got everything else.
I mean,
it's got a pool.
Yeah, so now Will has been thrown in there, but... We forgot Donovan and Ramona are running around doing, like, buddy team things for the last couple episodes, which it's not important, so we didn't mention it. But now Ramona's in the walled-off area because Donovan double-crossed her. He knows where, the money is, and it's with Lady Gaga.
Yeah, he kind of acknowledges that there's a 20-year gap in my resume, and even back then I was an actor, and I couldn't rightly come back and do that.
Right.
So, yeah, he needs the resources of the Countess.
Right, so he has now tricked Ramona into being now in this walled-off area. Well, Drake's in the walled-off area, and Ramona kills him. The end. Or is it?
Until episode 10. Literally called She Gets Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, the Countess is just kind of stacking up enemies
within
her own home. The Cortez at this point.
No one likes her.
No friendly faces left.
Yeah, no one likes her. But she's like into Valentino and Natasha, sort of. More Valentino than anything.
Yeah, trying to make it work.
Yeah.
Too
much time's passed and he's been walled off. So also going on in this hotel, so now because like Gaga and... Donovan and Valentino and Natasha at some other hotel, which why? There's a free hotel here. I don't understand. It's free rooms, but whatever. Miss Evers and Liz now have started talking, which never previously. dealt with each other.
No, I don't think anybody takes Miss Evers very seriously. She's just kind of a fixture of the hotel.
And she's very singularly minded on J.P. March and stains.
Cleaning those sheets.
There are more stains in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
But in this episode, we find out a backstory of Miss Evers, and we find out partly why she's so kind of crazy and cheerful all the time. Mm. And it's because her son was stolen from her.
Not dissimilar to the Wes Bentley storyline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like literally turn your back and then the kid's in a terrible ghost costume, by the way. Terrible. And anyway, he gets driven off by another person and killed and dead in the end.
Yeah.
So that's a sad, sad part of the story.
It's her first like on-screen dirty sheet. That she receives.
Yeah. Oh, it's very gruesome and awful. But what it does, though, is convince Liz to reunite with her son, who, when Liz became Liz, as we know her in the show, she left her entire family behind.
Yeah. He was in town for a conference and never went back home.
He just never called. It's like the dad who went out for cigarettes.
Never came back,
and now is living glamorously as Liz, but always felt sad that he left his family.
Yeah.
And so we see this trying to get reunited between Miss Evers convincing him to call the son, and then the son being brought into the hotel.
Yeah, and I think Iris has some part in sort of offering him like a free stay
for a week at this hotel. Yeah.
The son doesn't know what he's in for until he's there. And it's such a sweet, and it's funny for a show that like it's a horror show. The moment where Liz is bartending and her son is there at the bar, and he's, very wholesome Midwestern guy, just kind of completely out of context in this hotel. But, we'll take the complimentary drink that he's been offered. And when they start talking and, there is like a very natural comfort between the two. And it's very sweet.
Yeah, it is.
And it's funny that like you see so much on Liz Taylor's face, like little moments that she's kind of clearly touched that like he turned out all right.
Yeah.
And he's not judgmental. He's sitting across from a person who, is on site cross-dressing. Done up, to the nines, and he's not judgmental.
Right,
he's kind of treating this person like a human being, as one should.
Right.
And Liz Taylor hasn't gotten a lot of that in her life.
No, and I think partly with Liz, because she's just such a great character, you can't like stop talking about her. But living in the hotel as she has and being so attached to Countess never actually did her any favors, because she didn't get a chance to experience that, some people actually are cool with this.
Yeah.
And almost in a lot of ways, Liz was completely stunted by the first time she walked down to the ice machine. That's where she is in life.
Yeah. And it's as if, the hotel is haunted with any number of ghosts, and she might as well be one of them.
Right, exactly. Because I spent most of the show thinking she was.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny that she does point out that she's not – she hasn't been turned, and she's not a good, like, she has to say it for you to sort of acknowledge, because otherwise you kind of assume, well, why else would you stay?
Right.
So the next two episodes we couldn't rightly talk about without spoiling, because they are the accumulation of all these plots. And in filling out Liz Taylor's arc over the next two episodes, we actually do get to see her sort of, become the public butterfly. This whole time she's been sort of sequestered to the hotel, but when she's dealing with Will and his fashion company, she does get to sort of, the spotlight that she, in her mind so rightly deserves.
Mm-hmm.
There was a really funny moment in the second or third episode where she sort of pulled away from teaching the people at Vogue how to Vogue.
Right.
And it was just a really funny aside, but like, she clearly wants the limelight.
Right.
And she hasn't gotten it. But when her story fills out and, she becomes a bigger figure in the context of the hotel, it's a great end. It's funny that the last episode doesn't have, there's not much pivotal to the last episode. It's kind of a perfect epilogue.
Yeah, because you find out. And it's hard to talk about without like spoiling it. So you just find out so many of these people what they wanted, and some of them achieve what they wanted and some of them don't. But it's a great way. It kind of reminds me of like Oliver Twist, okay, because there's a million characters and every single one has an ending. They might not all be good or happy, but some of them are surprisingly in their way, and some of them are very tragic, but every single character has a start and stop.
Yeah, and it's funny that even J.P. March, in thinking, I guess he's really thinking about the hotel, but in thinking about the hotel, one does have to accommodate that, you know, all of its quote-unquote guests, all the ghosts that live there would be without a home,
right,
if the hotel were to be demolished. So his plan to hold out for it to become a landmark in L.A., means that everybody's got to kind of fall in line and play ball.
Yeah,
that,
like no more killing all the people.
Can't draw any more attention to the hotel. And so that has a nice short arc in terms of the introduction of Sarah Paulson's secondary character as the psychic,
which
Billy Jean someone.
Yeah, and we met her in Murder House as well.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
We don't want to spoil the show for you. We've kind of given you bits and pieces of the compelling elements, but really the story exists in those in between the lines moments. But I really did like it. And it's funny talking about it. I don't know. It makes me appreciate the best points of it, and the Wes Bentley, Chloe Sevigny stuff falls to the wayside.
Yeah. I thought as I was watching this the first time, I thought, you know, I just really loved it because I love the music. I love the aesthetic of the whole thing. And yeah, when I rewatched it for this, I did fast forward through the Wes Bentley stuff.
And it's better for it, right?
Oh, yeah. It's awesome. I don't even care what's going on with that whole story. And it's a relatively big story, but I came for the clothes and the music. And I stayed for the clothes and the music, and it was great.
All right, so that'll do it for this two-part series on American Horror Story Hotel. We will be working up the next one. We're sort of working backwards, and we'll be doing Freak Show next.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that one's a little easier to come by. It's on Netflix, as are the previous seasons. But, find us on social media. We are at Rants Macabre on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our website is therantsmacabre.com, where we post all the episodes that you could download them from there. You know, we've got further details and images and videos by the time this goes up. I don't know what else. That's it.
We have an email. You could send us emails.
Sure.
Maybe tell us that we're completely wrong because a lot of people hated this season, but I loved it. So fuck you.
The email Mindy was referring to is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play Music.
Leave us a review.
Yeah,
why not? You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.